Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to have Josephine Inkpin as our special guest. Josephine is Australia's first out transgender priest. She's now serving as minister of Pitt Street Uniting Church in Sydney. Josephine is a historian, a theologian, and a social justice activist who typically works across many otherwise conflicting borders. Jo, it's really nice to meet you. How are you doing today?
Pretty well. We're out of lockdown in Sydney now. So we can, we can now travel across the world, but we can't travel to parts of Australia because parts of the states are shut down where they haven't got any COVID at all. So it's quite an extraordinary place to live in for all sorts of reasons at the moment. But we're going well.
Well, you're very welcome. Would you like to just begin by sharing a bit of your story of being a transgender person and being a priest? Do you just want to share a bit with the audience?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm just into my 60s now. So I go back to, and I was grew up in a little rural area in England. And I mean, in those days, when I was little, gay people almost prescribed, weren't they? Gay relationships and what's the name? It was illegal and everything. Mm-hmm. And trans people were very, very much hardly visible at all. So, and then we had Margaret Thatcher and Clause 28 and all sorts of awful things. So it was quite grim being different. So from an early age, I knew I was quite different. And, and I used to dress up in my mother's and sister's, to some degree, clothing and that sort of thing from an early age. But I knew I was quite different when I was very little and at school. I mean, it was quite a shock. I mean, I tell this story that when I first went to school, the first day they blew a whistle. And before they taught me the three R's, they taught me the binary because we had to get into two lines. And I remember there was a little girl, I think, or someone looked like a little girl who was a bit bemused as well. And in the end, I sort of got maneuvered into this line with these slightly more boisterous people. And then we got inside, there were places you could go to, sort of like, there were toys for girls and toys for boys and all that sort of thing. It's changed a lot now, but that was the world we grew up in. And yeah. So it was quite difficult. So I didn't have the language, I think. So I went into the churches. I went into social work a little bit to begin with after I left university. And then I felt a call to priesthood and then was involved in that and met my wife and we had some children. And then it's a little bit of a familiar story of quite a lot of older trans people of my generation. And then I started to need to express myself. And unfortunately, I had the support of my wife. But I would have come out earlier. I mean, I've only been out as a trans person for about coming up 5 years now, officially. But within the church, it's quite difficult. In England, the first trans priest came out just at the point I left for Australia. And if I'd stayed there, I probably would have come out earlier. But the Australians see that, trying to establish self made it difficult for me. So I came out actually round about the time my daughters both got married. And I suppose I felt I'd completed one part of my journey. And then it just became intolerable, really. And it's a huge strain, really, for a lot of people. Yeah. The longer you go, the better that, the earlier that people are able to come out and be themselves, the better. Which is why it's so vital to support children and young people who are gender diverse so they don't have to go through the sort of heartaches and sometimes anger, depression, addiction, all sorts of other things that older people have had.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much mental health issues for trans people because of those pressures, isn't there?
It is, yes. I mean, but it's an odd thing, isn't it, really? Because, but we're now off, as you know, off the mental health list. We were a mental... transgender with sort of being a mental illness for a long while. Yeah. Fortunately, we're on that. But I like to think, I had to go and see these professionals, the gatekeepers to allowing you to be who you are. Yeah. But I think the problem is as much, it's not sort of mental illness, but transphobia and what's that, it's embedded in our culture, isn't it? In Western culture, particularly. And so the problem a lot of transgender people have, I think, is, I mean, sometimes we have issues with our body and things that we need to correct, but that's not really the biggest. The biggest problem is other people's attitudes. That's what confines us, I think.
Why do you think, I mean, there really is a transphobia and there's kind of almost a moral panic around it. And it doesn't just come from Donald Trump and the likes of him. It actually, you know, there's feminists as well who kind of are very threatened by trans. What do you make of that?
Judith Butler, who, you know, one of the great thinkers about gender theory, she's written quite well recently about this sort of chaotic mass of ideas that are against transgender people, and they include people from like Donald Trump, just, you know, quite good, you know, in other ways quite admirable women and writers and some of whom I've admired, but it's quite difficult to do that now. So I think it's a mixture, but I think fundamentally I feel that sometimes people are, it's not just the particular thing, it's what we symbolize. And I think transgender people symbolize inevitably that we change and challenge others to where are their foundations. And in a world where there's huge insecurities, the need to have an identity or foundations built on a secure God or nation or gender structure is very appealing, I think, to a lot of people under pressure. And so we seem to be subverting a lot of all of those sorts of things, really.
Yeah. I think that's my understanding is, I find it amusing when people talk about non-binary and queer, and I'm like, well, we're all non-binary, really. There's no kind of a pure blue or pink baby born. It's like, you know, we're all somewhere on a kind of a...
Yes, it doesn't mean that when, I mean, sometimes I think when people think about gender theory, I don't know what you feel. Do you think that sometimes people feel like we're trying to deny any sort of, you know, sort of like physical reality? I think that's what I get sometimes from certain sorts of, you know, what's called transphobic feminists, that, you know, we're denying the realities of, for example, women's bodies, cisgender women's bodies, which I don't think, which is very much not the case. In fact, one of the ironic things is that transgender people, and they still do it a little bit, theologians, conservative theologians accuse us of being Gnostics in the sense, you know, people who believe in that, in a sort of like a spiritual identity, which doesn't correspond with materiality. In fact, I think it's the other way around sometimes. It's, you know, people have got some sort of saving knowledge idea of the world and haven't faced the realities of our bodies. And actually, one of the lovely things about affirming your identity is that you become more and more and become more comfortable with your body. You actually become into the body and you celebrate it more. But I think people sometimes feel that a woman stopped me in a talk. I did a talk up in Brisbane for a launch of a women's history project. And she was asking me about the trouble that some women have, and she was struggling with, of women, for example, who've suffered huge amounts of violence, especially sexual violence, and therefore feel threatened by some trans women, particularly perhaps if they haven't had, you know, if they've got penises or something. But it seemed to me that it's sort of misplaced a lot of this. I don't know what you feel. It's sort of like, for me as a woman, I wouldn't want, it seems to me that the problem is with where power lies, which predominantly lies with certain types of men, not men in per se. But that's where the problem is. And that's where we need to sort of work on these things and work together with other people rather than divide off against one another. And we're actually fighting sometimes the causes of cisgender women's issues and transgender women's issues are often much the same, actually. Focus, you know, the distribution of power and wealth in society, you know, the people who come from different racial backgrounds also suffer from those, you know, because power is concentrated in certain types of people, I think.
I think this is where it's very interesting because, you know, you talk about the LGBTIQ community and you would expect a kind of solidarity around marginalized people, around feminist issues. And yet there's that splitting off. There's kind of like, there's something else around trans which kind of symbolically kind of upsets people, isn't there? There's something kind of about the trans community that kind of does.
Yes, and it's a new level as well. It's for people like me, it sort of can fit a little bit into. People ask about my pronouns. I said, well, as long as you don't call me he and his, but I'm quite feminine, really, so I'm comfortable with she and her. But non-binary and genderqueer people, I think, are now opening up quite a different sort of space, and agender people as well, saying not that it isn't important to recognise the experience of people who have wombs, who menstruate, who maybe have particular features. So that's absolutely vital, and that's the difficulty. And I understand why women would be reluctant to sort of erase
differences
on those scores and the experience of women and our whole range of culture and experience that people have. But that's not what gender diverse people wanted. We sort of add to that. And as a woman, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, people just don't look at you when you're going to toilets or something check you out. And I think what people are beginning to find is that, an attack on a trans woman means that other cisgender women who look quite masculine, for example, then become likely. When we need to be looking at, well, what is a human rights for everyone? And that's a challenge. But I think it comes back to this transformation. I think there's, working in the religious sphere as I do, I don't know what you feel, but, when you look at the differences, one of the biggest things at the moment is religion a path of salvation from a Christian point of view, saving people out of things to give them security? Or is it a pathway, as it is in other faiths as well, but they also can be a security blanket sort of thing? Or is it a pathway to transformation? And that's what I think. It's not the only pathway. I mean, there's other things that need to be done. So a trans person, I think, challenges other people. And it's not just trans people. I once had somebody who was helping to, remove some of the hair off my face and things that come with puberty, and electrologist, and she was a bright young blonde woman, very bouncy and everything, and she said she often got funny looks from people in supermarkets and things, because she'd be it was almost as if sort of like, because she was positive about herself, that it sort of reminded them they weren't comfortable in their own selves. And I find in religious circles, and gay people do that as well, often find that, is that the people who are most sort of upset with this are people who are actually, it's not just us, it's what the effect has on other people, because we're finding ourselves. It's almost a challenge to them that they're carrying around things in themselves that they can't bear. It's not necessarily sexuality and gender, sometimes it is suppressed things.
Yeah.
All those sort of disappointments and all that sort of thing of, because it's so hard, isn't it, as a human being to realise your potential, to live freely. Because there's so much fear that we carry with us, or we've built into us, to actually express ourselves. And so I think to be someone who's willing to break through conventions and sometimes look fairly awful, go through this, is quite disturbing, because it challenges other people to say, well, what might you be as well in your deep self, and so people try and avoid that. I think that,
I think there's a huge social dissonance going on. I mean, like, on the one level we get pushed by consumer society and by general society to tell you you're free and you have free choice you're freer than you've ever been, and yet there's a real fear and anxiety around that, and there's a conformity, and there's kind of a fundamentalist kind of thinking, not just in the church, but kind of in liberal groups and in progressive groups. There's a fundamentalist around speech and stuff, and it's like people are retreating into smaller and smaller groups, and it's protecting and building walls around themselves. And there's a real dissonance going on in society, and there's something about the trans community, I think, and queer community and non-binary community, which, I mean, for me is like a really exciting and liberating kind of space, and always has been, like, before I kind of theorized, went to kind of try and understand this in a deeper way, hanging out kind of in gay parts of town. I'm a straight cis man, but loved hanging out in kind of Soho in gay places, yeah, because it just felt so.
So was that liberating? I mean, how did that work for you? I mean, is that because a lot of straight masculine, or certainly in the past, masculine world is sort of so so inhibiting, really? I mean, that was
absolutely. I mean, I was a poor nurse, so I used to kind of go to charity shops and kind of buy cheap clothes and stuff, you know. I didn't dress conventionally. If you went into town, and you know, gangs of men would be dressed with a kind of their white shirts and go into the nightclubs and stuff, and I wouldn't be allowed in, and I wouldn't want to go in anyway, because it is actually physically threatening, like, you know, if you look different or you'd be threatening. So I go to the gay club and I'd be very welcome there, and it'd be kind of party time, and my god, didn't it be party, you know. It was fantastic.
That's right. I once had a parishioner, and it was a very strong opponent of marriage equality and everything else. And they said, and we had this little discussion, and they said, oh, but we've got to save these poor gay people. And I said, what do you mean? I said, because they're so sad. I said, you're just meeting the wrong ones. Exactly, yeah. It's been pretty grim and all that sort of thing. But I think you're right about the diversity. I mean, sometimes it's tolerance and respect, but there is that sort of thing, a little bit, you know, and there's a lot of cattiness and what's next. But I mean, that's what I find very odd is, I mean, there's a bill in New South Wales Parliament that would outlaw any discussion of transgender people and stop transgender people being, you know, officially in schools, or whatever, in the state system, from one of our right-wing parties. And the assumption is, and it talks about a transgender ideology, which I've also heard, you know, quite sophisticated feminists talk about. And I think, have they ever met, especially transgender women? Because, I mean, we're like a bunch of cats, really, you know. I mean, we're lovely if you stroke us nicely and everything. But, I mean, we can spit at one another as well, you know. And that is a feature as a person of faith of sitting in a very odd place as a queer person of faith, because there is this God versus the gays and the trans sort of narrative. And so, I mean, I think people are far more complex and nuanced. And I guess that the strange sort of alphabet of LGBTIQA, et cetera, is almost a sort of, it is moving us into that spectrum, trans people moving out of that, you know, you're gay or straight, or into a much more sophisticated thing. When I was coming out, I spoke to a pastor from the Metropolitan Community Church, you know, which is one of the most positive, has been for many years, was a breakthrough church for gay particularly, and then trans people. And I was talking about the rainbow, and I said, I don't necessarily quite identify with the rainbow, the two bright colours for me are like pastels and things, and the trans flag. And he said, but the thing is about the rainbow, of course, is that the rainbow is actually, it's not just a few colours. It's an infinite number of colours and a sort of a kaleidoscope, which is the way I like to look at life and gender and so on, as a kaleidoscope. Something that's shifting as well, shifts over time. So what you, Simon, were, say, when you were 17, you're not the same person, are you, when you're 27 or 37? We change. Now, we may not change as dramatically as, you know, we've been living in one gender thing to another, but all of us change, and we change in our lives. And so that's one of the gifts I feel of transgender people. I've said this to people, you know, there's been questions about my marriage, for example. We've been married for 30 odd years or whatever. But now there's a question. We were married in the Church of England church and everything, but now we couldn't get married in an Anglican church officially because we are two same gender people. Well, we could in America. But it's a curious thing. And there was a question asked in the Church of England when I was ordained and brought up in it. And the bishops came, whether or not, you know, transgender people, if they're, you know, in the same situation, my wife, whether we should be divorced or we should get divorced. And they said no. And their reason was they didn't want to encourage transgender people to get divorced because they didn't want to sort of encourage divorce, not because marriage is really great. You know, I mean, maybe they forgot it, bless them, the bishop. But that's the thing, is that if you've been through an experience like my wife and I have been, and not all transgender couples with a transgender partner can manage that, and that's fair enough.
Yes.
But a lot do. Then getting through that big shift, we've surely got something to help other people go through other marriage, you know, other marriage or stages of life, you know, that way you handle things where the person you thought you'd married isn't quite the person that you, and that can be a surprise, it can be an awful surprise, but it can also be quite a delight as well. You know? And
yes, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what you've, I mean, do you feel that there've been, you know, I mean, people say the talk about us transitioning. I mean, I'd call it more like affirming my identity, but in a way I am a different person, even if I hadn't sort of officially, as it were, changed my gender. I'm still very, I am the child that grew up in England, but I'm also another person and I will evolve into something else. And I don't know if that's what you feel as well. You know, there's the threads in our life, but we're not the same person. I mean, all the cells in our body change, don't they, after a number of years. And I think you hope that you evolve, don't you? I think.
Well, hopefully. That. I noticed my evolve, you know, it's like if I go back to Bristol where I was brought up and I see friends and things, it's, you know, I'm a very, very different person. You know, I'm to the factory I worked in, to kind of the area I look in, I'm a very different person. And you know, I've had many life experiences which have shaped me and expanded me and kind of hurt me and all those things. You know, great sadness, great joys, great kind of experiences. And you know, how that kind of, and I'm looking forward to the next adventure. It's like, I'm looking forward to kind of like, you know, this constant kind of process. And it's like, for me, it's that is life. That is the joy of life. It's kind of like, it's like being on that journey. And
so your track, this is the thing. This is my part of my thesis. It's that everyone trans is, everyone is always trans for, sometimes against our will, as it were, sometimes more willingly. And part of spirituality is coming, you know, it's the old prayer, isn't it? You know, of accepting what we can change and what we can't, and embracing it and looking forward to changing, you know, and even to death, which is, you know, which is one of the big issues that we also have to face is, you know, I don't know whether you know that sadly he died a number of years ago, but the beautiful, brilliant writer, priest, poet, John O'Donohue, Irish writer. And he used to talk about how you should approach death with almost a little excitement. So, I mean, not a horrible death, because, you know, it's another frontier into which we're going. We don't know what's going to happen. But if you've had an experience of transformation in your life and you've come through maybe terrible things as well, and that it has been rich, why would we not expect that there would be a possibility anyway of the next, or at least entering into it, not fearing and fighting life, but finding a way to hold even the awful fears and anxieties in a way that it doesn't let them burden and oppress us. And I think that's, for me, is part of the heart of spiritual life. You know, that's what Buddhism tries to attempt to do, Christianity in its own way, Hinduism, you know, that these things are not ultimate because life is always changing, that sort of transition. But I think there's some of the religious imagery and so on sort of encourages some people to feel that if only they could get to the fundamentals, or there's a rock to cling to, whatever, when in fact God is a mystery, not a fixed rock. And even rocks change, don't they? That's the thing. Do you know what I mean? Over time, they weather and what's next.
Well, I remember an experience of being in Iceland, and I was, I'd always had this metaphor in my mind that, you know, if I got anxious or if I got troubled, I go for a walk into nature, or I'd walk on solid ground. And I got to Iceland and I realized that the ground wasn't solid because it was bubbling away. It was like volcanic, and it was like, it was all moving, and it kind of, okay, even the ground's not solid, even that's fluid. And that was actually very helpful. It's like, okay, we're on this living planet. This is not kind of a static thing. A living planet, a changing planet, and it really kind of moved me kind of emotionally and sort of cognitively. It kind of helped me understand like everything is kind of moving and transitioning, and it's about embracing this expansive idea rather than trying to kind of confine it to some conservative or fundamental or kind of building a wall. I mean, that gives you like a temporary kind of reprieve. It gives you a temporary kind of safety, you know, to sort of say you've got the space, but actually it just builds up a greater anxiety, and it doesn't kind of solve the problem. It's like, you know, the problem is we're all transitioning. We're all kind of in a process. Yeah. We're all on a journey. And, you know,
and I mean, and, so, things last longer than others, don't they? I mean, mountains, but they're always constant changing. I mean, I don't know whether you know, there's a wonderful British artist called Andy Goldsworthy. He's sort of international.
I love his work, yeah.
He works with nature, you know, yeah, with things. So, I mean, I was born up in, my accent doesn't show, but in County Durham, you know, where there are lots of stone walls and so on. And they look like fixtures or whatever, but Andy will take something like that, and instead of making it sort of like a boundary or whatever, they're beautifully crafted, aren't they? Because they're carefully weighed and shaped and whatever, put into place. But he will take them and sort of weave them as a sort of, as an artwork or something, and show how stone itself eventually falls away, and the flow of rivers and the change of the seasons and so on, which ancient peoples, you know, and our First Nations people in Australia try and remind us of that, sort of a chat, that we live with this thing. So that there is continuity, that's the thing, but change, I mean, I sound like a historian, don't I, continuity and change, but sometimes we're so desperate to claim to continuity. And it's a thing, I don't know whether you find it in terms of moving away, but I mean, as someone who's English, you know, you think a lot more about what it is to be English when you're not in the country. So for example, I mean, I never thought I really had much of an accent. Well, I mean, obviously I know about English accents and whatever, and the Irish accents and such like. But when I came to Australia, people, you know, sometimes pick up on this, that you're obviously English, but it's not a thing, you know, not something that you've sort of thought about. But when you're in another culture, you do a lot of work of both understanding that culture, but also understanding who you are. And the danger is you can end up being, you know, a caricature of what was. Do you know what I mean? That you can be. And I remember somebody from the Iona community coming to speak in Australia, and she said that she'd gone to America to one particular group of Scottish exiles, you know, there, and they'd been there. They went there in the 18th century after when the English banned the tartan for a short while. And she was invited to a ceremony of celebrating the tartan. And she said, why are you doing this? You know, as a Scot, I mean, she's a dedicated, you know, very right on sort of Scots one. And they said, oh, no, don't you do this in Scotland? She said, no, because we got the tartan back. We'd sort of moved on, you know, so you cling to these old traditions.
Yes,
you know, what it is to be English or whatever is this or that. But I mean, that's what fascinates me, being, you know, coming, is seeing how over time, I mean, it's dramatic, isn't it, at the moment in Britain, with Brexit's changed. But Ireland's changed a lot as well, you know.
Ireland's been through an amazing transformation. It's like, I've been visiting Ireland since the 1980s. I kind of was best man at a wedding here for a friend when I was 20 years old. And and since then, this kind of Catholic, fundamentalist, kind of conservative country, you know, we've now got a gay Taoiseach who's kind of ethnic. It's like, you know, they've got gay marriage. It's kind of changed, which you could not have imagined over such a short period of time. Yeah. It's really very, very interesting how that has changed. And just the feel of the country, just the feel of kind of people feeling more liberated and less constrained and stuff. It is quite dramatic, really.
Mm.
It's inspiring.
And it changed, doesn't it? I mean, my grandfather was, he's buried in Belfast, actually, because that's where the same. And his second wife is a rabid ultra sort of Paisleyite sort of person. But he wasn't. I mean, he was a cradle Catholic and everything else. And Ireland always seemed to me to be quite an intimidating place in a way. But now, in many ways, it seems to me to be more at peace with itself, or a lot of it anyway, and with being part of a world, a wider world, than Britain does. And in a way, as a country, it seems to me, like reflecting on my own sort of national identity as well, it's sort of at some stage, and we've got problems here in Australia at the moment of a country that isn't really at ease with itself, you know, at ease with history, painful history, awful colonial history here, and destructive, but also at ease with itself. You know, there's a big row at the moment between Australia and France because they built this little alliance with the Americans and UK, which doesn't make any sense. This little sort of Anglo alliance in a world that needs to be able to find a way for different identities to work together and different nationalities to work together. And what's very sad, isn't it, is the undermining of a lot of those carefully developed relationships between different countries. And so people have sort of retreated into themselves. And I see that as what I'm sort of saying is that on a public level, on the bigger level, the group level, that's what's happened. And on a national level and on a group level as well, you know, people come together and they defend themselves. We're this type of person against that type of person. Yeah. And it's quite sad because it's losing that nuance and complexity and diversity that we are all this thing. And that's what I find quite lovely being, it's very, very painful, but in a way it's quite disruptive being a queer person of faith because we're breaking the narrative. You know, how do you change a narrative? And I think it's often it's the marginal people who don't fit anywhere really who do that. And they, it's quite costly to be like that. You know, if you're neither male nor female or whatever, then you're likely to cop it from different sides. But actually you're changing the narrative for people. So we get beyond the old male-female battles. Do you know what I mean? And which is freeing for most people, actually, I think, not for those who've got investment in being male or female in that way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it aligns to kind of bigger changes sort of when we're thinking about systems theory and quantum theory and biodiversity and nature. It's like we've learned that there aren't these kind of clear divides. As, you know, the idea of modernity was all about pure divides and clear divides. Yes. They tried to get nations into categories and people into categories and kind of, you know, and that led to some terrible things happening, you know, genocidal things happening, you know. And actually to live in a world which is a healthy world, you need biodiversity and you need diversity. It's like that's how it is, you know. And I think that making this mistake is what you were saying earlier about trans people, as if you want to kind of erase kind of femininity or erase masculinity. And it's like, no, that's not what it's about. It's like about expanding the notion of that. It's not kind of raising it.
Yes, well, that's it. But I mean, that I think that's it. But can we just have a little bit of a space to be? Do you know what I mean? But how does that, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Are those identities so fragile that people are holding on to sometimes so much that what we challenge is actually that we've settled for this. And I know that in my own life, you know, of having to settle for living within a particular thing because it was just too difficult to do something else. And a lot of people in the world have that, don't they? I mean, let's face it. If you're not with the Taliban in Afghanistan, you're really going to suffer. Do you know what I mean? That sometimes it's sensible to pull back or find a way to do those things. But when you've sort of made a, it's not a deal with the devil, but it's sort of, you know, you've done a compromise, really. To put up with this. You know how it is in families and marriages sometimes, you know, we'll put up with this, even though we don't, you know, it's not really good, but we'll do it. This is about as good as it'll get. Yes. And I think we're sort of, a lot of trans people would say, well, we call people into something. I mean, that's it's fascinating, isn't it? There seems to be a little bit of a link between some people on the sort of autism spectrum and being transgender. And I think, and I don't know that's because the two are necessarily closely correlated, but the way I see it is that people who are neurodiverse are often got a very clear idea of themselves or will stand up for things in a way that I would sort of compromise in a way. You know, someone like Greta Thunberg.
Yes, yeah.
Extraordinary campaigner because she's sort of fairly single-minded. And I think it's, in gender terms, a lot of people, you know, well, I know I'm female, despite what other people say. Whereas I sort of would say, well, I want to know, well, why can't I go into ballet with my sister? And why can't I wear clothes on? Because you don't do it. Yeah. And then you go, oh, well, I'm obviously upsetting my mother or father or something. So it's that sort of nonconformity that's always changed the world, hasn't it, really, in a way? Do you know what I mean? And unless someone steps out of the box, that's what makes it. And then people, and they can either get crushed, crucified, literally. But even if they do, they've broken the mold and they've asked the questions and maybe the emperor hasn't got any clothes anymore, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, change always came from the edge, and you know, social change has always come from social movements, and it's you know, it's always been the case. And you know, in the churches, in just in the nonconformist churches, they make the changes, and then they slowly get integrated into kind of the mainstream kind of traditions, don't they?
And that's what I think a little bit, you know, I mean, I you know, as a historian, a bit of your first wave Christian feminism, I find, you know, I'm hugely admiring of you know, that those who've opened up the doors for women. But I think second, there's a sort of a bit of like second wave feminism that's still fighting the old battles. And I think that's the danger, is that, you know, what one generation of people need also to change. You know, feminism has, you know, changed in its formulations into, I think now, you know, because, for example, womanists pointed out that it was actually a lot of second wave feminism was still very white and yes, middle class.
Yeah.
So other issues sort of come. And then that's broadened into a more intersectional basis of social change. And trans people are just one element of that, I think. But that's why I love the image of the kaleidoscope, because that's what I feel is, that's one image I've got of God, really, of a changing mystery that will express itself in different ways in different people, you know, the image of God, and it will change. Yeah.
So theologically, you take a position of which be very different from a kind of the church can go in different directions, and you can see Pope Francis struggling with this. He's kind of you kind of get the feeling that deep down he kind of believes in a much more liberal kind of open space, and yet he's got the politics to play, and he has to kind of try and hold things together and the pressure, so he doesn't quite say what he believes.
Yeah, I think it's to me. I mean, I think that some of the great, you know, spiritual writers, the Christian writers at the time, talk about this element of transformation. You know, people, for example, Richard Rohr, Joan Chichester in America, lots of different people from the Christian side of things in the Catholic Church, and I think that's the fundamental theme in spiritual as a whole and in the Bible. It's about change and liberation, I think, a lot of it. But there are also elements there that are about control. And I think a lot of people would like to, you know, a lot of more right-wing or conservative people would like to see religion as a, you know, a stronghold against change in a world that's changing, instead of something that allows transformation. And I think Pope Francis is an interesting fellow, isn't he? Because, I mean, coming from Latin America, he knows that transformation is absolutely crucial on a social and economic level for his people, and spiritually and ecologically. You know, I mean, that's what the popes have done quite well, I think, over the last little while, is talk about ecological change, the environmental challenges, which require a transformation, a conversion, spiritual, social conversion. It's not just a technological fix, as it were, like our prime minister here thinks. It's much deeper than that. So I think they understand that, and it's returning to a transformation which is based on compassion, isn't it? That's the thing of suffering with people, or companionship, you know, sharing bread with people. Like, they're the fundamental things that Jesus was on about. And I think Pope Francis, you know, at his bed, that's what he's about. But he's bound in this extraordinary structure that has lasted for 2,000 years nearly. And
I'm working a bit with the Catholic Church at the moment, and they got interested in my ideas on eco leadership, and they're trying to talk about this is led by Francis around a synodal leadership, a new synodal way of running the church, because I mean, basically, just they know that this is a dying church, because there's just not enough priests in the West anyway, and you know, you can't get enough priest training, you can't get, you know, and they have to kind of allow lay people, allow women to take a much more greater role. They need distributed leadership, which is kind of what I talk about a lot. They need to kind of blur the boundaries between leader and follower. Like, these aren't fixed positions, it's like gender. Yeah. Change, yeah. As you know, if you're in a church, you know, you rely on people around you to kind of take leadership, you know, at different times. It's not just kind of you running the show. And I think he understands this. And rather than kind of go head on battling with kind of the, you know, the Catholic kind of politics, he's setting up things at the edges. He's very interesting, I think. You know, he's setting up change at the edges, and he knows that's where change takes place. That's where liberation takes place. You know, empower people, give them the opportunity to use their potential, and it will change. And I think he's very interesting what he's doing. Yes.
Well, I think that's the hope, isn't it? You're right about chat. I mean, when you think back over, well, Pope Francis, I mean, he's taking his name from the great saint who was, I mean, extremely marginal in one sense. But again, an example of someone who's changed and a force for change and thing. So it is about empowering that. And I mean, one of my great sort of queer heroes is Anglican priest Carter Hayward, and she's written, and one of the things she said is that use institutional resources where you can. And that's why I'm still in the church and in it, because I think there is value in that, you know, and I wouldn't want to throw all that. But at the same time, create new ones. And that's the challenge. If you funnel all your energy into an institution as it is and fighting that or trying to change it alone, we don't get anywhere. So to my understanding, you know, first wave Christian feminism, struggle for the vote and that sort of thing, was they understood that there were people, you know, the suffrage, they won the vote in England because there were people inside the system who were doing that. Yes. But they were quite clear that this, you know, suffragettes and other people, the more militant people, you needed a broader movement.
Yeah.
But they needed both. And then they needed to build new alliances. And in the end, they started to build alliance with working class women. And then that scared the liberals and others at the time, because then they were going to lose votes. But it needed all sorts of people at different levels for that transformation. And that's why I've always spent a lot of my time, I think, trying to build partnerships with people who are on, if not quite on the same level, on the same, you know, not necessarily having exactly the same things, but where we can work together and where we're sort of in part of that same creative spirit of transformation.
Sure.
And that's what happens, I think. I don't think it's going to come through one particular thing. And that's a hope for the Catholic Church, in a way, it seems to me, because the Catholic Church has got, it seems very hierarchical, but it's got all these orders and it's got this extraordinary range of people and enterprises going on, doesn't it? You know, and
it's very interesting. I mean, the Protestant churches are always kind of split off into different denominations, but the Catholic Church kind of hangs together in this kind of web of life, which is kind of got so much diversity. You've got liberal theology on one side, you've got kind of high church Catholicism on the other side, and it's like, but it all kind of just about hangs together in this kind of web. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's that thing. I mean, John Paul II wasn't always great, but he did a fantastic speech in Australia to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people back in the 1980s. And one of the things that's always struck me, that he said, the church in Australia will not be the church that Jesus Christ wants it to be until your gift has been offered and joyfully received. And I think it's a tremendous thing, because for all sorts of groups of expressed, we have to offer our gifts. We can't wait for other people to come and do it.
Yeah.
But they do need to be joyfully received if the bigger group needs to be that. And I think it could be transferred. I mean, I've used that a lot ecumenically in things to people. Say, you know, until the Romanian Orthodox have offered their gift in Australia, the church in Australia won't be what it is. Until queer people have done that, until trans people have done that, and it's been joyfully received. And it's important, the joyfully, I think. But it goes for other organisations, doesn't it, really, in a way? I would have thought, I don't know, that would be my thing. You know, unless workers on the shop floor, as it were, their gifts and their energies are there. If you just leave it to the people at the top, as it were, until everyone's gift, and that's the, well, I mean, it's not the only way to run a show. You can run it as an army or something. But even then, you need to be able to develop the gifts of your lieutenants and other people to...
Yeah, no, I work in banks, I work in big corporations and stuff, and they're interested. It's not just altruism which drives the need for distributed leadership and allowing people to kind of fulfill their potential. It's actually, you know, you need, you know, to be a successful organization, whether it's a school, a hospital, or a bank, you need to be more adaptive. You need to kind of be more fluid. You need to kind of use all the potential. So you have it at your
people's perspectives, isn't it? I mean, I mean, the church got itself partly in a mess that's an understatement, about abuse, you know, child abuse.
Yes,
partly, I think, in some places, because people weren't empowered to question or think, you know, where there was too much of a deference culture, too much power given to bishops and other people, or priests, and you didn't like to say something because... But if you can create a culture where everyone is able to contribute, it doesn't mean to say you can't have, you know, your Episcopal structure, whatever, but it's more responsive, I think, to to have people.
You know, and there is a myth, you know, I work in social movements as well, and there's kind of a myth of being leaderless and not having structure. We do need institutions. You do need kind of a structure as well. But within those structures, you need to kind of liberate people and empower people and allow people to fulfill their potential. And it's not just kind of this top-down kind of weightiness. It's getting things in kind of a more harmonious balance. Joe, listen, we're coming to the end. This has been such an interesting conversation. We could go on and on. It's lovely, lovely talking to you. And I really appreciate the kind of gift you're giving to the world. And I'm joyfully receiving it. I end the show usually by asking people if they've got anything to share with the audience around what it means to live a good life and create a good society. And I wonder if you had any kind of thoughts after our conversation.
Well, I think it's back to the, in a way, it's back to this of entering into your integrity, I think, and not living a false life. I mean, we just had that short thing about the greatest commandment, which is to love God with all that you are, or to love the mystery of life or whatever with all that you are, and all bits of you, and even the bits that you find quite shameful or difficult, or other people tell you is shameful. That's part of my journey. And then to love your neighbors yourself, until you love yourself. And I think that wisdom starts, you know, that's the ancient thing, is to know yourself. And so that's why I think it's not an either or. We have to have this, why it is a community and an intersectional thing, is there needs to be people working like yourself in organizational change, people in politics, very difficult area to work in, and then people working on the heart, people in body. But that inner thing, that inner attitudes, until those things are resolved, then there's all sorts of things that will rise up and stop us living a good life, because we may intend to do this, but the shadows or things that we won't sort of own. Mm-hmm. And we maybe need one another to help us bear those. And some of them might be hard to ever resolve, but until we do those things, we won't get anywhere. And I think that's the same for a nation, you know, like Australians, until we face our hideous dispossession of Aboriginal people, we'll never really be fully whole, as much as it's a marvelous country with a lot of beautiful multiculturalism as well, because we need to be true to who we are and our place in the world.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your wisdom, and sharing your gifts through the world. It's been lovely talking with you. Go well.
God bless.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. We'd also like to thank our sponsoring organization, the Eco Leadership Institute. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more about related events, our coach and leadership training, or our webinars, contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com or go to www.eco-leadership.institute. Thank you for listening.